From my point of view, good afternoon, morning, or I suppose evening, depending on where you are around the world soundly covered one way or the other by this, the largest program of its kind in the world. I'm Art Bell. My guest is Dr. Sean Carroll, and your turn with Dr. Carroll is coming up. Just a couple of more itsy-bitsy little questions, and then we're going to open the phone lines. Keep it planted. Dr. Carroll, here in Southeast Asia, in Asia, I live in a country that is predominantly, overwhelmingly Christian. America is overwhelmingly Christian. Could it be, Doctor, that money for the kinds of things that we were talking about, accelerators and such, is not exactly forthcoming so quickly in North America because of that Christianity, because the answers that ultimately may come from this line of experimentation may provide alternate answers to God?
I don't think so myself. I think it's a complicated question. It's a good question. I think that in this particular case, the answers are a little bit more down to earth, a little bit more mundane than that. Basically, you know, fundamental physics has been probing the nature of space and time and matter and where the universe has been coming from for a while now. And traditionally, people have been able to both be religious and support that kind of thing, or to not be religious and support that kind of thing. I haven't heard any, you know, in when you talk to both policymakers and scientists at the funding agencies, the kinds of things you hear are not those kinds of things.
Those wouldn't be the kinds of things you would hear.
But there is a public discussion going on. So if someone had an opinion that this isn't the kind of thing that you should be doing because of that reason, they wouldn't get very far unless they told somebody. I have heard some things like that. There was a famous example, and I don't know the exact quote, so you shouldn't believe me, where Al Gore was a little bit startled to think that particle physics was going to be telling us about the nature of the Big Bang, because that was religion's territory. And I think that there are some people who think that, but I don't get the impression from the actual people making the funding decisions that that's foremost in their minds. In fact, I heard a very elaborate talk from a senior official at the Department of Energy who was celebrating how physics was illuminating the same kinds of questions that religion had been asking for thousands of years. So you can spin it that way just as well.
I guess you can. And then, Jim, I get these questions on a computer as we go along with the program. Jim in Sandy, Utah, says, somewhat flippantly, when I daydream, a blue collar gets into trouble. When your guest daydreams, he gets paid big bucks. Have we actually gained anything from his or any other scientist's daydreaming?
I think the bucks are perhaps not as big as he's imagining that they are. No one ever goes into theoretical cosmology and particle physics for the money. Let's put it that way. It's a lot of work. There's a lot of people who want to do this for a living who don't get to. But he raises a serious question. You know, what good is it? Is it worth the money that we put into it?
Yes.
There's two answers. One is that there are plenty of good things that do come from basic research all the time that you can't possibly anticipate. It's not as if, you know, you gave Alexander Fleming a lot of money at some day in the past and said, make penicillin. You said, you know, do some research and understand how things work better and see what comes of it. And that's how a tremendous amount of scientific progress is made. So the short answer is yes, a tremendous amount of good comes from people daydreaming. And the other answer is that even if it didn't, it would still be worth doing because it's not that much money and it is answering questions that we all care about, or at least many of us care about. We just want to know the answers when it comes to for everything from where the universe came from to, you know, how we evolved and what life is like deep underneath the sea and whether there's life on Mars and all of these questions. These are big box office, and for good reasons.
All right. Are you ready for some spooky interaction?
I'm ready.
Okay, here it comes. Wildcard line, Stan in Florida. You're on the air with Dr. Carroll.
Yes. Well, first of all, it's the idea of daydreaming. That's what makes us human, and that's what has made us, you know, the dominant species on this earth. Anyway, one of the things that I wanted to bring up, you know, you were talking about time travel and stuff. We look at what we call UFO interactions here on this planet. And understand, I'm retired Air Force. Back during the Israeli airlift in 1973, I was stationed in the Azores Islands. And everything that we were sending to Israel came through the Azores, which was an enormous amount of material. We had visits by UFOs not less than once a day. My car one night when I was going to work was flown over by a UFO buzzing our airport. Mm-hmm. Now you say, well, okay, the government doesn't believe in this. Then why did they send a team in when it was over to debrief all the people that worked on the flight line and every air traffic controller on that base on what they had seen?
Stan,
where this ties into time travel is that, you know, the paradox, you say you can't go back and kill your grandfather, you know, and still live and stuff like that. Okay, what if time travel is what we're experiencing in these UFOs, that our experience, you know, is, you know, future humans coming back and observing or gathering data? You know, they're historians, per se.
Okay, it's a worthwhile question. Let's pose it in a slightly different way. Dr. Carroll, there are enormous numbers of reports. Even our military, which is radar-tracked, unidentified craft that traverse our atmosphere at just 25,000 miles an hour and faster. And these cannot be ignored. I mean, there is a substantial amount of real evidence that there are things in our skies that are completely inexplicable, traveling at speeds and in ways that would turn humans into jelly. And I wonder if it's worth your comment in any way at all. Could we be visited? Are we perhaps being visited and just simply haven't proven it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the time travel question is actually interesting in its own right, but it's a little bit separate from the UFO question, which,
yes,
as a scientist, the way that we think is to say, you know, you're judging between two different hypotheses, and you have to judge which one better fits in with everything else that we know. And one of these hypotheses is that there are intelligent aliens who have super advanced technologies and are buzzing us in their UFOs, which we are able to detect occasionally on our radar screens, but nevertheless do not detect out there in their solar system or communicating via radio waves or any of the other ways that we can do it, and that these aliens have chosen to remain hidden from us, and that we do not see any evidence from their existence from other solar systems.
Mm-hmm.
Or you believe the hypothesis that there aren't any aliens there and that these reports are some combination of misreadings and atmospheric phenomena and other planes that you didn't know about.
Mm.
And almost every scientist will come down on the side of saying that a combination of very mundane explanations are a more reasonable fit to these observations than to really believe there's a race of intelligent aliens who are hiding from us but occasionally show up in eyewitness reports and radar reports.
Very well said. Until you've seen one yourself. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Carroll. Hi.
Hi, Art. My name is Bill, and I'm calling from Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. My question for Dr. Carroll this evening is, back in physics, I learned that the law of conservation of energy and matter, that matter can neither be created or destroyed. Now, this is the first I've ever heard of dark energy. I'm wondering where the dark energy is coming to fill the expanding universe. I mean, it has to come from somewhere.
No, that's a great question. Very good. You're halfway to being a professional cosmologist right there, just by catching on to that. The very short answer to this question is that in an expanding universe, energy is not conserved. So it's true, you were taught when you took Physics 101 that energy is neither created nor destroyed, but you weren't taught about the expanding universe at the same time. And the rules change a little bit once you realize that space-time is curved and the universe can expand. And it's something that actually sort of has been tested in other parts of cosmology that we probe quite accurately. So when the universe expands and the dark energy remains a constant amount of energy per cubic centimeter, but the number of cubic centimeters goes up, it's true, the total amount of dark energy goes up. On the other hand, when the universe expands and photons, ordinary light, travels through the universe, that light loses energy because it's redshifted as the universe stretches the wavelength of the light. And therefore, the total amount of energy in photons is not conserved either. And there's just no law that says the total amount of energy in the universe remains a constant. Instead, there's a law that says, given a certain amount of expansion in the universe, here's how the energy will change. So if that expansion's zero, the energy would be constant. But you basically have to give up on your belief in the law of conservation of energy once you realize the universe is getting bigger.
All right. Bill in California, west of the Rockies, your turn.
Hey, good evening, Art. Good evening, Doc. How are you doing tonight?
Good.
Fine.
Thank you for taking my call. Hey, I got a theory that I've been talking to about. Actually, I called you once with it, Art, quite a long time ago, like 10 or so years ago. And it premises like this. Say for the sake of argument that we have a universe that exploded from a Big Bang, and it's essentially a ball-shaped thing. And if we draw a circle on a paper with a radius of 15 billion light years, put a dot on the outside representing a planet looking back at that, say 16 billion light years away from the center, and we're on that planet looking back at that particular circle, what will we see? And the answer I would say is nothing, because light hasn't gotten there yet. But we would see or register quite a lot of mass. Perhaps we would see it as a black hole. So my first question is about the expansion possibilities of a black hole. And the second thing is about, well, let's say for the sake of argument that my premise is correct, what would happen when that black hole's event horizon finally hit the Earth?
Well, I think that I'm not going to make you very happy with my answer, because I'm sort of going to unask it, because the image of the Big Bang that we know and love as an exploding fireball expanding through space is not, I think, the right way to think about the Big Bang. In our part of the universe that we observe, forgetting for the moment about the possibility of other parts outside that we haven't yet observed, the Big Bang is not the expansion of some stuff into space. It's the expansion of space itself. There isn't any outside. There isn't any center point from which everything is expanding. The amount of space itself is getting bigger. So there's no edge. There's no middle. There's no edge. Every point is moving away from every other point.
I kind of understand that premise. I'm just kind of using the vision of a circle to kind of simplify things for myself. But if it was, for the sake of argument, to be in that situation, we would say kind of sort of that our universe was a black hole, and perhaps other black holes would be therefore universes. And when we're looking at a black hole, is an expanding universe. I mean, there's technically no space or time in these things to begin with. So,
there is actually space and time inside a black hole. The real difference is that in our universe looks the same everywhere on very large scales. So we look in all directions around us, and we see the relic leftover radiation from the Big Bang. In a black hole, there is a special direction. There's, you know, toward the middle of the black hole, which is different than away from it. So our universe looks different from a black hole in the most basic feature, that it just looks the same all throughout space, as far as anyone can tell.
Okay, east of the Rockies, Charles in Florida, your turn with Dr. Carroll.
Hi, I guess my question, I have to pose a question, would be, if someone called you, and I know there's at least one other that's called into the show, that is down the path, or let's say in the orbit, of finding the everything theory, would you even listen to them?
Well, sure. It depends on what they had to say.
Okay.
There's. Let me put it this way, and I said this before. If someone working somewhere had come up with a plausible and promising and innovative theory that was better than the theories that we already have and typed it up and sent it to me, and I'd be very happy to promote this obviously brilliant idea. On the other hand, if someone thought that they had a theory that was better than anyone else's, but really didn't and didn't understand the current theories, the general relativity and the standard model of particle physics and quantum field theory, then I would ignore it. And there are a lot more people like that. So, I mean, it's hard to invent a new theory of everything, and it's impossible to invent such a theory until you've mastered the theories that we already know and love.
Well, I'm about as obscure as a clerk in a patent office, okay? But I'll give you three teasers, I mean, to describe it all. It's a simplistic theory, of course, as Einstein said. And by the way, Einstein said that in science, without religion, that's being lame, and religion without science is blind. I got three teasers that'll make you think. Okay, first of all, in mankind...
Well, hold on a second, caller. Did Einstein say that, doctor?
There was some quote very much like that. I don't know the exact details, but that was close enough, yeah.
All right, very interesting, caller. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll give you three teasers to make you think and maybe make you know that perhaps like this other gentleman who called in the show, we're both on the same road or path or orbit to the everything theory. First of all, in mankind, his senses, he's unable to determine certain things, but he is able to imagine with that wonderful attribute of imagination. First of all, there is no beginning or end. You see, mankind has a lifespan. The bird in the birdcage dies, his house pet dies, his TV goes on to blink. All he ever knows in his immediate surroundings is there's a beginning and end. But he has to learn there is no beginning or no end in anything in the universe. Okay, now with that in mind, I want you to remember when your mom and dad told you, as my mom and dad told me, that as you get older, time will seem to go by more quickly. Well, it's a scientific fact, and I can prove it, that science, time standard is changing. It's noticeable within our own life tenure as a human species. It's a stretching of time, oxymoron, time standard. What we're observing, and each generation observes in an escalating way, is that there's a time standard change. For instance...
Caller, we just don't have any more time. I understand where you're going, and I share with you the impression, the feeling that as you get older, time is going faster, but it in fact is not. Doctor, would you agree with that?
It's 1 minute per minute as the actual time goes by. There's, of course, a psychological perception of time, which is a more complicated question than that. But I also want to say something sort of in the background here, which is that I'm a big believer that science is for everybody. It's not just for people who have PhDs and so forth. Everyone should be able to understand ideas and think about them and appreciate what is going on in the universe. But coming up with new ideas is hard, and you should have a little bit of respect for the generations and generations of well-trained people before you. And if you want to come up with a new idea, that's great. But you should first figure out what the old ideas already are. And everyone should, you know, take their spare time and pick up books on general relativity and cosmology and particle physics and learn
and
some
go
stuff
from there.
We've already discovered about the universe, because there's
Got
great
it.
Stuff.
Hold it right there, doctor. We'll be right back. By the way, Wanna Take a Ride comes directly from the movie Contact, my favorite movie of all time. It's making the rounds on the pay channels again right now. And if you've never seen Contact, or even if you have, go back and see it again. God, what a movie. Dr. Carroll's website is preposterousuniverse.com. That's preposterousuniverse.com. I fairly sure we've got a link up on coasttocoastam.com right now. I see no books as yet. I thought in his world it was publish or perish. We'll ask about that when we get back in a moment. Why the name preposterousuniverse.com?
Well, the phrase preposterous universe is one that I came up with to emphasize the fact that on the one hand, we have over the last 10 years done an amazing thing. We figured out the inventory of the universe. Ordinary matter, dark matter, and dark energy, we know what proportions it is. On the other hand, it's not what we would have guessed. This is not as simple and as elegant as the universe might have chosen to appear to us. So there's something preposterous about it, which, like I said before, is something that physicists love because it means there's something we don't understand, and we're trying our best to invent better theories in which all the preposterousness will make perfect sense.
Huh. In other words, more work.
Oh, yes. We're not finished yet.
You have not yet written a book that I can tout.
I have written a book.
Oh, you have? Oh,
what, but it's
where?
Sadly, it's a graduate-level textbook. You're welcome to tout it, but I wouldn't really recommend it unless you're in graduate school. It's called Space, Time, and Geometry.
Oh.
Someday I will write a book that will be for my mom to read.
It sounds like you ought to. You're obviously capable of explaining things in a way that I can almost understand. The exact Einstein quote, by the way, courtesy of Denison Plover, Wisconsin, is science without religion is lame, religion without science is blind. Would you agree with that or argue with it?
No, I wouldn't agree with it, actually. And in fact, I think that we should be very cautious when interpreting Einstein talking about religion, because he had very, he didn't always mean the same things that the rest of us mean when we talk about God or religion and so forth. Einstein had a sense of wonder at the universe, which he spoke about in religious terms, which is very different from a more conventional church-going kind of religion. But I think that what he was getting at is the fact that science by itself doesn't tell you how to live your life. Science tells you how the world works, tells you the laws of nature. But how to judge good and bad, or beautiful and ugly, or right and wrong, is not contained in any amount of scientific investigation you might do. It's going to come from somewhere else, whether it's from religion or from human agreements and careful considerations. Different people have different ideas, but science just tells you what happens.
Well, that's fascinating. Wildcard line, Mary in Hazleton, Pennsylvania. You're on with Dr. Sean Carroll.
Hello, Art, and hello, Doctor.
Hello.
Pleasure. I'm having trouble here. I'm taking a college course in physiology and anatomy, and I'm studying cells right now. And the dark matter, is dark matter when two atoms collide and bond and it sort of makes a mistake and dark matter comes out, or am I totally wrong?
That's a very colorful idea, but it's not really right as far as the dark matter is concerned. If only it were that easy. But if you're studying cells, then you know that those cells are made of molecules. And if you keep digging down, those molecules are made of atoms, and those atoms are made of electrons and protons and neutrons, and those protons and neutrons are made of quarks. And as far as we know, that's where the layers stop. But in that whole list, there, dark matter is nowhere there. Dark matter is something else, some other kind of particle that we haven't figured out yet. We haven't made it in the laboratory or detected it directly here on Earth. But we know it's there because it has a gravitational effect, because there's many, many, many such dark matter particles out there. So one of the big projects over the next 10 years is to detect the dark matter particles directly, to make them at particle accelerators like the one at CERN in Geneva that we've been talking about, and also to build very sensitive detectors deep underground, far away from cosmic rays and other interference, that can actually feel it when an individual dark matter particle bumps into one of the atoms in the detectors. So this is a headline to look out for in the newspapers over the next 10 years. Physicists detect dark matter. once and for all. That's something we're all hoping for.
Dr. Carroll, Nikola Tesla was working on energy essentially from the ether, from air, from nothing. Energy that I guess he didn't fully understand, or maybe he thought he understood it. I don't know. Does dark matter and dark energy represent a future of Nikola Tesla's dream come true and our energy problems essentially solved?
Well, all I can say is that I would be extremely surprised if that were the case. The dark energy in particular is sort of the most useless kind of energy there can possibly be. You know, if you imagine having a gallon of water, if that gallon of water is at the top of a mountain, you can do something useful with it, because as it comes down the mountain, as it rolls down, you can put a little flywheel there and extract energy from it. But once the water is down in the valley, it's useless to you in terms of getting energy out. Mm-hmm. And all the dark energy is down at the bottom of the valley in this particular metaphor. So the fact that the dark matter and the dark energy are very hard to interact with at all, and the fact that, especially for the dark energy, their form of energy is kind of useless, would make it extremely, extremely surprising to me that we will ever tap into them as practical energy sources.
But I don't one pretty soon. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Sean Carroll. Hi.
Hey, hey, Sean. How you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, this is Dave. I'm sitting here alone in the dark at a security guard at a cement plant. You know what? I just happened to think of something. I've been waiting to hear somebody say it, a doctor, but they haven't hit on it. And it's just something that kind of irks me. Okay, when people think of a black hole, okay, they think of a, you know, the term hole means something you can go through, okay? So, you know, okay, oh my gosh, well, you know, what's on the other side of a black hole? What, you know, what if we go through a black hole? Are you going to be in an alternate universe? No, see, what's going to happen is, you know, a black hole is not actually a hole at all, as far as I understand. I may be wrong, and I'm kind of asking you this, but rather a collapsed star or something of that sort. You know, let's say it's you know, it could be anything you said, but let's say it's a star, for example. It's collapsed down to a massive thing that weighs the same as it did, you know, before, but just the size of a golf ball. You are not going through that. You will go into that, you know. And they say, well, what about the event horizon? Okay, well, the event horizon simply is just the point of no return where you cannot escape the gravitational pull, and you are going to go slamming into that thing. And, yeah, you know what I mean? But you are not going to come out the other side of it. I mean, is that correct or not? And Art, real quick, I want to get your okay to send you some pictures of an orb. You know, some orbs and a story behind it. I'll go ahead.
Okay, all right. Feel free to send those along. In terms of the black hole, you want to take any of that on, Doctor?
Yeah, I think that actually everything that the caller said is right on the money. He could be giving a guest lecture to my general relativity class, because the black hole, we think from the metaphor, from the words that are used, is it's a hole you come into and then go out of, but it's not. The black hole is a point of no return. It's a region of space where if you enter it, you can never come back out. But what happens when you do enter it is that you are driven inexorably to a singularity, to a point where space-time is infinitely curved and the gravitational field will rip you apart. And we don't understand that singularity just as we don't understand the purported singularity at the Big Bang. So I can't tell you exactly what happens there, but every indication of things that we understand are that bad things happen. You don't pop out in some other part of the universe. You get ripped to shreds.
Did you happen to see the movie Contact?
I did.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the story about Carl Sagan and Kip Thorne?
I do.
The book Contact actually spurred a lot of research in theoretical physics on trying to see whether or not time travel was plausible.
Mm-hmm. Is it in that manner? In other words, might wormholes be used for time travel?
Well, wormholes are a little bit different than black holes in a couple ways. One is that they may or may not exist. Black holes are firm predictions of gravity as we understand it. Wormholes are much more speculative. But what it would be is if you take advantage of the fact that space-time is curved to imagine that there are shortcuts through space and time. You can zoom in one direction and pop out very, very far away without really seeming to traverse a very large distance. And if Einstein says that space and time are mixed up, then if you can traverse very large distances very quickly, you can traverse time in interesting ways and maybe even go backwards. So the answer to your question is just a big maybe right now as to what is feasible in the real world. We can write down pictures of space and time that make it look as if you could travel backwards in time. Whether or not you could actually create such a situation according to the laws of physics, we don't really know the answer.
Doctor, do we have an Einstein alive on Earth now?
No. Einstein's dead. We have lots of other people who are really smart in their own ways. I mean, Einstein was not Isaac Newton. Isaac Newton was not Galileo, and Galileo was not Aristotle. Every new genius is new in their own way. We have some incredibly smart people coming up with incredibly good ideas, but success in science is teamwork between an incredibly smart idea and the universe cooperating. So we'll have to wait to see when someone is really going to make a breakthrough that the universe agrees is a good way to act.
All right, east of the Rockies. John in Nashville, you're on with Dr. Carroll.
Good morning, Art. Good to hear you. And Doctor, man, I hope I don't sound argumentative, but apparently you've never met Albert Einstein yet. You're speaking for his personal religious beliefs. Let's say, for instance, I've heard you mention a quark, and I guess Michio Kaku and you believe that the universe is a result of an exploding quark, which was all matter in the universe in this tiny singular piece of whatever it was.
Caller, he didn't say that.
Let me just ask this, Art. If the universe is a result of a Big Bang, what caused the Big Bang? There's no such thing, Art, and I believe that you know it, as an uncaused cause. So if it is a result of an explosion, what was the cause?
Okay, that's the one question I think Dr. Carroll's already said he can't answer. Is that correct?
Well, I think it's a good question in some sense, but I will change the rules of the game out from underneath the caller by saying that there's plenty of uncaused causes. The language that we use when we talk about causes is stuff that you and I, you know, make sense to us in our everyday lives. If you push something and it moves, then the cause of it moving was that we pushed it. And Aristotle and Plato would have said that the laws of physics work that way too. But we know better now. We know since Galileo and Newton and Einstein and other people that the laws of physics are a set of equations, and the stuff in the universe just solves those equations. There's no causes and no effects. There's just stuff doing what it should do according to the laws of physics. And the idea of cause is something that's convenient to us, an everyday thing, but it's not fundamental. It's not deep down there in the laws of physics. And when it then comes to the Big Bang, I don't know whether the Big Bang was the beginning of the universe or whether it came from some pre-existing stuff, but in neither case is there any necessity that there was something out there causing it. It could have just happened.
Going back to his initial comments, what do we actually know about Einstein's religious beliefs or lack of them?
Well, Einstein had sort of subtle and complicated religious beliefs, and I don't want to speak for his religious beliefs except to say that he was very comfortable himself using religious language in ways that didn't always correspond to a traditional religious belief. He grew up Jewish, and he often would say things like his interest was in figuring out God's thoughts. But as far as I can tell from having read a lot of what Einstein wrote, what he meant by that is he wanted to know the laws of physics. He thought, you know, that those two things were more or less interchangeable, that God had the vision of God to him was sort of the beauty of the way the universe works. And I don't want to go into the details of what he meant by that because I don't have the ability to speak for what he meant. But he wasn't a church-going kind of guy either. And finally, it doesn't really matter. You know, Einstein was very smart, but he was wrong sometimes. He was right sometimes. We have to figure out for ourselves how we should think about the universe.
Okay. Wildcard line 3, Mike in Ohio. You're on with Dr. Carroll. Hi.
Good evening, Art. Dr. Carroll. Dr. Carroll, in the Christmas Carol, when Scrooge is taken by the ghost of Christmas past, he could watch, but he wasn't able to interact. And Dr. Carroll, since observation affects our experiments, if we traveled out 10 light years and erected a giant reflector, and we used a super telescope to see our reflection 10 light years out, if this let us see 20 years into the past without being able to, say, change that past, would this observation have any more of an effect than, say, watching an old movie?
Well, I think that there's a short answer, which is no. It would have exactly the same effect as watching an old movie. We record things that happened in the past, and we observe those recordings, and they don't affect what actually did happen. And that's true whether or not it's an old movie or a DVD or a telescope put 10 light years away.
Would this qualify as a type of time travel?
In a sense. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about time, is that the past exists as our memory of it. And this is not my idea. This goes all the way back to St. Augustine, who, you know, in the 4th century was talking about the nature of time and came up with some very clever insights. And one of his quotes was, "The past is present memory." That the past that we think of is left behind in little records of our present state of the universe. And that's one of the aspects about time that is fascinating, because we don't have a future memory. We have records of the past, but not of the future. And why is that? And that's one of the things that physics doesn't quite understand right now. So,
If we took the reflector out far enough, would it allow us to, say, see the dinosaurs?
No. No, because the light that was emitted when those dinosaurs were there is moving away, and we can't ever catch up to it.
That's right. It's far gone. So we would have to travel faster than light, and
that's
I suppose
right.
We could travel faster than light and get out to a point where, of course, it would be too far away to look back, but if you could, yes, then you would see the dinosaurs, but that would require faster than light travel, which I guess...
That's right. So if you had a wormhole lying around, you could do it. But I don't know of any such wormholes. So,
Have you done many interviews like this, Dr. Carroll? I've not heard you before.
I've been on the radio a couple times, but this one is sort of the longest and most in-depth, which is good because you get the time to explain yourself a little bit more.
You're very good at it.
Well, thank you.
All right. Very quickly, first-time caller line, James, in Chico, California.
I wanted to ask the doctor to go back to quantum entanglement. If two people were to observe this particle and one was spinning clockwise, the other counterclockwise, and one was able to affect theirs to spin in the opposite direction, would the other one immediately spin in the opposite direction as well?
Uh-huh.
Well, I think that
okay.
You put your finger on exactly the issue, but it's an issue of words. The correct way to say it really is what I said, which is that if one is observed to be going counterclockwise, then you know for a fact that if the other person observes theirs, it'll be going the other way.
Yeah.
That
See, that's the part I'm not going to understand, because there should be communication. Doctor, there should be communication possible. We'll do another show, and I'll eventually understand
we'll
that. We're out of time. That's it. We're done. It was wonderful. You're a great guest. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me on the show, Art. Thanks to you.
Dr. Carroll, good night.
Good night.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've got a three-day weekend coming up, meaning I'll be here Friday, Saturday, and Sunday next. Until then, I bid you a wonderful week ahead. From Art Bell in Manila, good night.